I can say to my new Samsung Galaxy S25 Ultra, hey, find a keto-friendly restaurant nearby and text it to Beth and Steve. And it does, without me lifting a finger. So I can get in more squats anywhere I can. One, two, three.
Will that be cash or credit?
Credit. Four.
Galaxy S25 Ultra, the AI companion that does the heavy lifting so you can do you. Get yours at Samsung.com. Compatible with select apps requires Google Gemini account. Results may vary based on input. Check responses for accuracy.
This episode is brought to you by Intuit TurboTax. Didn't file with TurboTax last year? That's in the past. Now, Taxes is getting the TurboTax app and filing your own taxes for free if you didn't file with them last year. File by February 18th. All tax forms, all 100% free. Now, this is taxes. Intuit TurboTax. New filers and filers who didn't use TurboTax last year only must start and file your own taxes in-app by February 18th. Excludes TurboTax Live. Full terms at TurboTax.com.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. From streaming to shopping, Prime helps you get more out of your passions. So whether you're a fan of true crime or prefer a nail-biting novel from time to time, with services like Prime Video, Amazon Music, and fast free delivery, Prime makes it easy to get more out of whatever you're into or getting into. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to learn more.
Hello, welcome to the Snooker Scene Podcast. I'm Dave Hendon. Mark Selby is back. I would argue he'd never really been away. Not really. A bit different to Neil Robertson. By the way, Mark Selby won the British Open on Sunday night, for those of you who avoided the news. Neil Robertson won the English Open last week, but he had dropped out of the top 16. And, you know, he had sunk a little bit in the rankings. Mark Selby was still, I think, world number 5 last week. So, okay, it's been 18 months since his last ranking event, but here's the thing, okay? Mark Selby has won a ranking title every year now since 2014. I'll say that again. Mark Selby has won a ranking title every year since 2014. That is the longest current run of any player. No other player stretches back that far in terms of every year winning a ranking event. There have been some gaps between them, but he's still a regular winner. Now, he'd been in the doldrums, but it was more, well, two go together. It was more a personal thing than a snooker thing, and off-table stuff had affected his snooker. We know he's had mental health troubles. His wife, Vicky, had breast cancer. Clearly, these terrible things in the real world are going to affect you. They affected, I think, his enthusiasm for snooker. He didn't like going away to tournaments. But he's a strong-willed character, and as he proved in the final against John Higgins, and indeed matches prior to that, but certainly the final, certainly the first session and the last mini-session, he's a phenomenal player. Stephen Hendry described him at his best as unplayable because he's got every single angle, or puns intended, covered. You know, he's a terrific safety player. He knows the right move, the right shot at every point. He can get you in all sorts of trouble. He's a great layer of snookers, escaper of snookers. He's a great shot maker. He's got real cue power. You know, he's a break builder. He's got temperament. He's got bottle. All of this stuff. Sometimes he struggles to kill matches off maybe as quickly as he should. And, of course, he had the 4 deciders in a row to go with the 2 deciders he'd had at the English Open at the end of that tournament. But he won 5 of the 6 of them. And more comfortably came through against Mark Allen in the semi-finals and John Higgins in the final. So for Mark Selby, it's ranking title number 23. It caps what felt like a long week, an eventful week, an emotional week in Cheltenham at the British Open. Of course, he won the Clive Everton Trophy. And I'd like to start the podcast by just thanking everybody who's been in contact about Clive's passing, including several players. And we have had quite a few emails, as you'd imagine, which I'll be going through through this episode. But well done to Mark Selby. Now, of course, he's not actually qualified for the Wirren Open, which is the next event, although he will be playing. He's got the headline slot 9:30 a.m. on Tuesday morning at Ponds Forge. Talk about, I've never been to the Lord Mayor's show, but they always say, you know, after it, he's no good. Well, this will be no good, but I'm sure Mark will give it his best. He's got to play the qualifier for the International Championship at 9:30 on Tuesday morning. At 9:30, I mean, not worth going to bed, really. Anyway, it's a busy circuit, it's a busy tour, and that's what we like. What we also like, and that's a segue, is your emails. We've had a lot in about the tournament, about Clive, and, we're going to go through them, otherwise I'd just be sat here basically twiddling my thumbs. So I'd like to start with if I may, Kelly Barker, great friend of snooker, great friend of the podcast. And she writes this: I'm so very sad writing this email after hearing of the sad passing of Clive Everton. He was so much more than a snooker commentator and journalist. He was Mr. Snooker in every way, and his amazing contribution to Q Sports for well over half a century will never be forgotten. I never met him, but did speak to him on the phone briefly once when I rang up to renew my subscription to Snooker Scene magazine. I was lost for words when the great man himself answered in the same voice that I'd heard on TV for so long. I thought the whole ITV team did him proud on Friday when his death was announced, as it must have been one of the hardest days to go on air and get on with the job. It's what Clive would have wanted, though, and you all did a fantastic job and deserve great credit. Thoughts are with his family and all who knew and loved him. How apt that the winner of the British Open trophy will lift the Clive Everton... Sorry, the winner of the British Open will lift the Clive Everton trophy. Taking on the authorities is not for everyone, but Clive always stood up for what was right for the sport he loved, and he had so much to be thankful for. And we... Sorry, Kelly, I'm butchering this email. Taking on the authorities is not for everyone, but Clive always stood up for what was right for the sport he loved, and we have so much to be thankful for. There will never be another Clive Everton, but I think you, Dave, are the nearest we've got to a modern-day Clive, and I mean that as the biggest compliment. All we can do now is enjoy the busy snooker calendar going forward and never ever forget the great man. Well, thank you, Kelly, and, you know, that's very kind of you to say that. In terms of, yeah, listen, I was, myself and Phil Yates, we knew that Clive was very ill, and we knew this day was coming soon, and we both, I think, were dreading it happening during a tournament. But actually, in retrospect, I think we were both very glad that we were there at a tournament with our friends, with our colleagues, with people who knew Clive, who respected him, who loved him. And that was certainly true of the ITV team. And they had about 3 hours to prepare. The programme obviously had to change what they were going to do. And I thought they all did an amazing job. You know, television, you know, it's only telly in one sense, but equally, there's a hell of a lot of work goes on just to get on the air, never mind the content of the programme. And what you saw was genuine. The emotions expressed and the intent behind it from everybody on the team. I won't start picking out certain people because it'd be unfair, but the names you would have seen on the credits on Sunday night, they all played their part. And I think it came across on screen. It wasn't just obligation to do it. They did it because they wanted to. They meant it. Everything that was said was meant. And I saw Kelly, actually, you tweeted on Friday, you know, I hope the ITV team are out raising a glass to Clive. That's exactly what we did do. It's exactly what we did. We had a meal and we shared stories, and it was actually in some ways a lovely day, even though it was a very sad day. It was a lovely day to be able to spend time with people who knew Clive, worked with him, and, you know, there was laughter, there was tears, there was everything. But I think we did honour him, and I said I wasn't going to single people out, but I do want to thank Rob Walker for the way he handled the minute silence. I thought that he was impeccable in, you know, what can be misjudged, I think, but it wasn't. It was done really well. It was very moving in the arena. And as I say, it was actually, although it was something that, you know, I thought might be difficult, to be there on that day actually was quite special. And you know, we did what Clive would have wanted us to do, which is get on with the snooker. So that was also very much our focus. But thank you for that. Jonathan Ford says, I just wanted to pass on my thanks for your touching tribute to Clive. While it is very sad for the snooker fraternity, it probably pales into insignificance compared to those who worked closely with him and knew him as a friend and colleague, such as yourself. That emotion was evident in your verbal tribute. This year we have seen the passing of two giants of the game, Ray Reardon on the table and Clive off the table. Both in their own ways contributed hugely to the progression of the sport and acted as the conduit between the age of snooker we know today and that of the 1980s, and thirdly, the age before colour television. The fact that in between both their passing we saw the future of snooker with the Saudi Arabia Masters is the realisation that nothing has changed, but everything is changing. Snooker needs to embrace such change, otherwise it will wither on the vine. We've seen this threat before in the 50s and 60s and again in the early 2000s. We owe a huge debt to Ray and Clive for their efforts, as without them and their respective and equally important efforts, snooker wouldn't be where it is now as the thriving sport it is. We all, whether it's a player, administrator, journalist, official, or as myself, a passionate fan, have a responsibility to see the game thrive and flourish further in the memory of Ray and Clive.
Thank you, Jonathan. Very nicely put. we have now Nick Cowie. He says, thanks as always for the podcast. Your tribute to Clive Everton was very eloquent and perfectly poised. I'm so pleased to hear you speak of his commentary on Ronnie O'Sullivan's 1000th century, the storybook ending. As a snooker fan since 1980, with the tones of Clive, a familiar part of watching snooker through my life, hearing him being part of this occasion is probably my favourite moment in snooker. The perfect snooker commentator, the cadence, the tone, the perfect silences and perfectly delivered one-liners. We remember Clive Everton. Thank you, Nick. Marlon has written in, Marlon Solomon. He says, I didn't know Clive Everton and I never met him, but he was my snooker hero. It may seem strange that this position isn't occupied by a player, but perhaps fans of long format sports such as snooker or cricket can understand the sort of attachment one may feel towards a favourite commentator. The time spent in the company of this stranger has no real parallel I can think of. For me, Clive Everton was that person. Maybe it's because in those sports, which may have long spells between moments of drama, you're simply whiling away the hours with them. Those hours become days, weeks, years, even decades. The broadcaster is the fixed point, the constant, the old friend in the corner of the room. Years ago, people often referred to listening to Uncle John when they tuned into the John Peel show. It was as if they were checking in with an old pal. So it has been since my student days when the snooker came on, and out of the TV came the reassuring voice of the person everyone in the house called Uncle Clive. He was to broadcasting what Mozart was to music, the ultimate exponent of his craft. His intricate knowledge of the game was matched only by his mastery of the English language. Understated and precise, friendly yet authoritative, highly intelligent, thrifty with his words, and gifted with a vocal timbre that was easy on the ears. He had it all. As a broadcaster, he had some very special idiosyncrasies. Perhaps the one I most admired was how, during commentary, he would often speak in paragraphs rather than sentences. He had this wonderful habit of finishing his comments with an upward inflection on the end, a signal there was more to come. It would be where you'd place a comma in written speech. Then he would pause to formulate the continuing thought, which would also end with an upward inflection, and so on and so forth, until he wrapped it up with a conclusion that would finish on a downward inflection, the full stop. Then the cycle would begin again. Whether he honed this art in the days when commentators could only speak every three shots, I do not know, but it was uniquely endearing and testament to his supreme skill as a commentator. As a viewer, it always kept you hanging, waiting to hear his next thought. Perhaps it was his way of ensuring he never wasted a word or spoke for the sake of it or resorted to needless superlatives or hyperbole. These were the things Clive Everton never did. Instead, he saved the eulogies only for those special moments. One clip during the rounds recently was Mark Selby's clearance against Sean Murphy at 16-all, where you hear him bask in admiration for Selby as he clears up. Such heart, such skill. His usual brevity gave moments like this incredible power. He always added to the emotion and the drama. He never subtracted or distracted from it. Then there was his intellect and knowledge, which appeared to stretch far beyond the Green Bays. Given the literary and historical references that he sprinkled his commentary with, the viewer could be forgiven for thinking he was as comfortable talking about the complete works of Shakespeare as he was reminiscing about the Rothmans Grand Prix. And he was funny. His dry wit and ultra-sharp turn of phrase would often make me giggle, something that also shone through in his writing. His wonderful book, Black Farce and Cue Ball Wizards, is filled with some fabulously withering broadsides at those who had done him wrong. For example, when discussing the person responsible for first sidelining him at the BBC, he said, soon afterwards I noted he was accepting freelance jobs as humble as directing camel racing on two cameras in Dubai. His one-man battle against corruption and cronyism in the game was as remarkable as it was heroic, a determination to expose the truth, no matter the personal cost to himself. He also gave a snooker scene in the pre-internet days, our only way to keep abreast of developments within the game. But it's his commentary I admired the most, because he was simply the best, because he was never shy to let you know that he was enjoying this as much as you were. I'll always remember one fabulous match I watched at home on a second Crucible Wednesday, that weird morning session where the first quarterfinal comes to a close. It was Marco Fu versus Ken Doherty. And if memory serves, the score was something like 11-10, both players playing perfect snooker, a huge amount of tension. An engrossing safety battle ensued. The stakes could scarcely be higher, but neither player blinked. After a long pause in the commentary, Clive suddenly exclaimed, "This is marvellous." And it was. It really meant something when he spoke like that. The gravitas he had cannot be overstated. At times like that, it felt like he was just another viewer watching with you instead of a commentator. When ITV replayed O'Sullivan's 1,000th century, there's a moment when O'Sullivan starts playing to the crowd before potting the final ball. And Clive Everton just reflexively laughs with the audience. He was part of the crowd when he needed to be, but stood apart from it when necessary. My deepest condolences go out to his family, to his friends, to yourself, David, his worthy protégé, to Phil Yates and all who knew him. Rest in peace, Clive Everton. You will always be missed. Well, thank you, Marlon. That was that's quite an email. That's quite an email, and much appreciated that you took the time to write it and to send it. And thank you very much for your thoughts there. Tony Finnegan, he said, thank you for the emotional and sincere memories about Clive Everton's career and life. I never had the pleasure of meeting the great man, but I do have a little story concerning him I'd like to share with all. I was a subscriber of Snooker Scene magazine for many years, which I enjoyed. For some reason, one year, when I paid my annual subscription, I was charged twice. I sent an email to Snooker Scene on the matter and received in the post a refund check signed by Clive Everton himself, apologising for the mishap. I showed my friends the check and gloated. This qualifies as a Clive Everton autograph, surely, due to his signature. It shows his attention to detail and, more importantly, the respect he had for his readers and followers of this great sport. I'll always remember Clive and his individual style, using only the players' surnames in commentary, and phrases such as snooker from the gods and two up with three to play. Rest in peace, Clive. You'll be greatly missed. Thank you, Tony. You're right, actually. He did have a lot of respect for the readers. I mean, Kelly was talking about ringing up and having him speak on the phone. And he enjoyed, let's be clear, he enjoyed taking down subscriptions as well on the phone. But, yeah, yes, he did care about the sort of the community of readers very much. Daniel has written, I've just listened to your wonderful tribute to Clive. I thought you spoke beautifully and summed up what I think all snooker fans thought about Clive's contribution to the game. I'm certainly aware to him proud. It was a brilliant pod full of emotions, but carried real weight and was a poignant tribute to someone we'll all miss hearing. Well, thank you, Daniel, very much indeed. And we now sort of, if you like, well, no, we've got a couple more, actually. Sorry, I was going to say we sort of straddle into the British Open, but we do have some more. As usual, this has been very poorly planned. Martin Devlin, he says, reflecting on the sad news this morning, I've been trying to figure out why Clive was my favourite commentator. Perhaps it's just that he was a soundtrack to my youth. We all get nostalgic for the good old days, but it's more than that. Clive struck me as someone you could have a chat with about snooker and be in complete ease in his company. I think this is because Clive, in my opinion, was the least hyperbolic commentator in any sport, never mind snooker, a trait that is unappreciated and also suggests a complete lack of ego. This shone through along with his love for the sport when listening to him. He let the game speak for itself. I can tell the influence he had on you, as these are similar traits in your commentary. It's why I enjoy listening to you on TV and the podcast. Clive's contribution to the game was enormous. While he may not be the most consequential figure, it's hard to think of anyone who loved the game more. May he rest in peace. Thank you very much, Martin. Mark Williams, but not that one. A sad day today, as we've just learned of the passing of the great Clive Everton, the greatest of commentators and an all-time favourite of mine. He had a really good view of a situation, whether it be a match he was on commentary for or an overall opinion regarding snooker matters. I like the fact that he stood up for the people, players and his principles rather than bending to the establishment. An all-time great guy. I can't remember when, but must have been during the 90s sometimes. I'll always remember Clive defending Alex Higgins during a discussion. I think it was after Higgins announced his retirement in a drunken slur. Clive was saying how there were a lot of truths in amongst the words and how unfairly at times Alex had been treated by the snooker establishment. I must try and find this on YouTube. Of course, Clive himself possibly wasn't treated fairly over the years at times, but always stuck to his guns. He'll be sorely missed and always remembered. Thank you, Mark. We'll come back to your comments about the tournament. But we'll continue. William Callahan, like all snooker fans around the world, I was deeply saddened to hear of Clive's death. Ironically, while watching the action on Thursday evening, I was sat there wondering just how Clive was doing. I grew up listening to Clive's excellent commentaries, first with the BBC and then on to ITV. It was always a pleasure to hear his dulcet tones. He was simply a colossus in sports broadcasting. But I remember him especially for all he did to protect and support the game, especially as editor of Snooker Scene, and for fighting various regimes who did not have the best interests of the game at heart, whereas Clive certainly did. Sending Clive's family and friends, especially yourself and Phil Yates, my deepest sympathies. Rest in peace, Clive. Thank you for all you did for snooker. Thank you, William, very much. Now we're going to also talk about the tournament that we've just seen, the British Open. Callum Law, he says, I hope you're okay and what I imagine must have been a difficult week for you. First, I'd like to say I thoroughly enjoyed the British Open. As a John Higgins fan, it was great to see him go on a run again and get straight back in the top 16. How very John to only be out for a week and get straight back in. Just on that, I mean, that was extraordinary because we were sort of writing the sort of professional obituaries of John Higgins, really. You know, out of the top 16, after 10,738 days, it took him 7 to get back in. And there was no real... I mean, look, he could drop out again, obviously, but there was no real sort of detriment to dropping out. I think he's seeding in the Northern Ireland Open and International Championship, obviously, is reflected in dropping out. But that doesn't make a lot of difference, really. He would have had to qualify for the international. He's seeded through to Belfast anyway, so it's not made that much difference. Anyway, Callum continues. The final left me disappointed because I thought purely by law of averages, as much as anything, that this was the time for John to end his barren run in finals. But every credit to Mark Selby. He's a player I've always admired and respected a lot. And with everything he'd been through on and off the table in recent times, it's good to see him back in the winner's circle. The biggest compliment I can pay Selby is that when he plays at his best, he's got the ability and all-round game to be able to beat any player that's ever picked up a cue. Also, I know everyone likes to moan about things nowadays, but I wanted to say I always enjoy the ITV coverage and was also very impressed with ITV making a second table available to watch on ITVX. I watched quite a few matches from Table 2 during the week and enjoyed the commentary from Michael McMullen, Joe Perry and Stephen Hallworth. I know for ITV it costs more to show Table 2, but I do hope they feel it's worthwhile because the service was excellent this week. If I may, I'd also like to pay tribute to Clive Everton. When I started watching snooker almost 20 years ago, he was the voice. His commentary, frankly, was on a different level to anyone else before or since. Having also watched lots of old matches from before I started watching snooker, I feel fortunate to have been able to enjoy so much of Clive's commentary. His closing remarks when Stephen Hendry won his 7th world title is my personal favourite. It just summed everything up perfectly. Finding out more about Clive, I've also been able to appreciate the huge contribution he made to snooker as a journalist over so many years. I must have read about 150 sports books, but Black Farce and Cue Ball Wizards is the best I've ever read, and I've read it 3 times. Anything Clive was involved in, he added integrity, gravitas, credibility and respect to, and I hope that's how he is remembered. Lastly, I remember the BBC airing a feature about Clive during the 2007 World Championship on what was his 500th day working at the Crucible. I've never seen it since, and I'd love to see it again. Hopefully someone out there has the footage. R.I.P. Clive. Well, if anyone does have the footage, let us know. Just thank you very much for those words. Just on the second table on ITVX, so there's some really good matches on there. And again, it was a service that wasn't available before. You're right, people do like to complain about things, and there were complaints about it, but the service didn't exist before. Now it does. And I know a lot of people did enjoy it. And like I say, they got the Maximum on there, which was brilliant, Mark Allen's Maximum. I'm sure that the numbers will be crunched and hopefully that will be done again. Alpha Bonzi, Alpha Bonzi is a little bit like the leader of the opposition, the Prime Minister's questions. Now, I think they get 6 questions. He gets 3, and these are the 3. He said, after Mark Selby finally breaks... I'll answer them one by one, Alpha. After Mark Selby finally breaks the ITV curse at the end of a sad week for the game, number one, how proud would Clive Everton have been of Selby's mental fortitude, both on and off the table? Well, I could tell you Clive admired Mark Selby hugely. He admired all the players, actually. You know, he liked different styles. He liked the contrasts. But he admired anybody who reached the top because he knew he was a player himself, remember. He knew how hard the game was. And Selby's sheer willpower, determination, he admired greatly. Number two, Ronnie O'Sullivan pulls out of his 3rd British Open out of 4 since it returned to the calendar. What about this event doesn't he seem to like? I don't know the reason he pulled out, but as you say, it is a bit of a pattern. Clearly his focus is on non-British events, although there's some discussion about whether he's going to be in Wuhan this week. But weirdly, and I don't say this as any diss to Ronnie, he kind of wasn't really mentioned all week. You know, so much else going on. And that's the thing with the spotlight. If you're not in it, someone else will be. There was so much else going on in what was a very busy tournament. That we kind of didn't really mention Ronnie. I don't know what he was doing. I hope he's well. I hope he comes back playing soon. Number 3, how much credit goes to the crowds in Cheltenham that no matter what, they seem to turn up in their droves. And I'll answer that. But he says, finally, a quick suggestion. To pay tribute to your legendary colleague, maybe Wednesday podcast could be Clive Everton's top 10 commentaries. Thanks as always, especially for the obituary for Clive posted on the World Snooker Tour website, a fitting tribute to the voice of snooker. Thank you, Alpha. The crowds in Cheltenham were good. But this comes, I mean, no one's actually, I don't think anyone's written in about this, but I'm going to have my say because I think the format needs to change. I don't think the format works as it could do. The crowds were very good on the first day because it was well advertised in advance who was playing. They were very good from about Thursday night to the end because you have last 16 quarterfinals, semifinals, finals. So you know where you are in the tournament. That middle bit, and this was the case with the home nations until they changed it just this season. The Tuesday and Wednesday, the crowds weren't great. Because there's a lot of confusion about who's playing, what round it is, what, you know, where it all fits in. Now, World Snooker announced ticket sales were up, which is fantastic. So they were higher than last year. Brilliant. No complaints about that at all. But I met someone, they actually introduced themselves, and they said, look, it's good value. I think they were paying £15, £20 a ticket for the whole day. So I'm glad I've come, but I've got no idea who's on. I couldn't find any information about who's on. And they weren't quite clear, and I wasn't clear either. I'm working at the event. What round it was, what was happening. It's very strange. Obviously, some matches were played a few weeks ago in the first round. Some were held over. But we had the situation, for example, where Judd Trump had played a couple of matches, and suddenly Dave Gilbert turns up, and Dave Gilbert plays two matches on the Wednesday. So Dave Gilbert plays first on day three, but he plays again in the evening. And you're trying to work out how did that happen? How does it fit in? What round is it? The biggest problem is, okay, the FA Cup style open draw, I think a lot of people like, but it hasn't been really utilised very well. Well, the draw was not made in the open. I mean, it's supposed to be an open draw, but we don't know who made it. There's no footage of anyone making it until the quarterfinals when it was made live on television. ITV don't want to show it early on because it lacks sustained dramatic interest, having 10 or 15 minutes of people pulling balls out of a bag. And the problem is Will Snooker want it done pretty early because they want to schedule the matches. They want to schedule the matches and tell the players when they're on, or at least fit them into the slots in the schedule. But that means it's all either or. And either or in a draw, as I say, is not exciting. So it's no good for telly. But they should still film it and put it on social media. They've done that in the past. They didn't do it this year. I think it was a big mistake because even though it's not a particularly exciting watch, footage of it should still exist. People should be able to watch it if they want to, so that at least they can see, you know, that it was done above board. By the way, I know the people who did it. It was done above board, but there's no reason not to film it. The argument I got back was, well, we can't monetize it, but that's not the point. That there is a part of the purpose of World Snooker Tour is to provide information. It's not just about earning money from it. It's actually about actually putting information out. It was very difficult for people to follow how this event worked, the format of it, which round you were in, who played who. Not just for people, for fans of the tournament watching on TV or coming, but those of us working at the event. It was very hard to find out what the hell was going on. And I don't see why it needs to be like that. And I think always the problem with these events, actually, is there's just too many matches. There's too many players there, too many matches. I think it can be streamlined. I think it can be tiered like some of the other events now. You could actually still have an open draw once you get to the venue. Maybe you could seed it before that. And I think the matches actually also, the length of matches needs to be looked at. Two best of sevens at night is a hell of a lot of snooker if it goes the distance. And we had, I mean, me and myself and Neil Foles did a finish after 1 o'clock. Neil Roberts and Rory Thor. They were following the Mark Selby match with Yuan Sejun that had gone the distance. 14 frames at night is a lot. You know, a best of nine used to be the staple. 9 frames is a lot. If you get all 9, that's probably half, 10, 11. That's plenty. Suddenly we're there till after 1 in the morning. So I think there's too many matches. I think it needs to be looked at least. I think it needs to be looked at and streamlined. And I think that personally would help ticket sales. I think if people know who's playing when, that would help. But it was a bit murky and a bit kind of hard to sort of grasp, you know, who what round people were in, who was going to play who if they won. all of that, I'd like to say, even if you're working on it, was quite hard to follow. It's I think Telly like the open draw, but they don't want to 10 minutes of picking out balls and it's so and so will play so and so or so and so or so and so. That's no good. But it's also no good that nobody could actually watch any of the draws. And like I say, World Snooker Tour, of course they have to monetize their content because that money goes back into the business, back into the sport, but they also need to provide information. And I have to say, recently, it's been very hard to find things out. For example, the Northern Ireland Open, okay, is on now, just at the qualifiers at the weekend, but the final stages draw was not made available. And as far as I'm aware, still not being made available. So we've had people qualifying for the venue in Belfast, but we don't know who they're going to play. Why? Why is the problem with telling people? Who's going to play Ronnie O'Sullivan? Who's going to play Judd Trump? I found out that Jimmy White will play Hossein Vafai. Jimmy got through. Fantastic for him. Two good wins, particularly against Jackson Page. That's a great win, 4-3 in the second round. People want to know who Jimmy's going to play. People want to know who they're all going to play. Basic information is still important, okay? And it's been lacking of late, and I think that's something you need to look at. In terms of the British Open, it got great from about Thursday when the mists cleared and you were left with, okay, the last 16, we understand how that works. Before that, it was kind of confusing. And I think it can be simplified, and I think the event can be built up more. It's a great event, the British Open, I think, but I think it can be simplified and streamlined, and I'd like to see best of nines rather than best of sevens as well. But one man who did go is Paul Regan, and I met Paul actually as well, so I had a chance to speak to him, and let's hear what he says about the event. He says it was a real pleasure to meet you. Actually, he didn't say it was a real pleasure. He says it was a pleasure to meet you at the British Open this week. I was conscious you were busy, so I resisted the urge to pick your brain on the afternoon matches, but I'm grateful you took the time for a brief hello. Thank you. It's also possible you're witness to my banal meeting with Ken Doherty, which consisted of nothing more than a polite nod just a few seconds after I bid you farewell. My visit to Cheltenham also opened my eyes to the benefits of live snooker's early rounds. Less than £20 for a day pass to watch several matches, including some top 16 players, and no queuing anywhere for anything, even the food. I even knocked in a few balls on a relatively empty table in the queue zone. Perhaps the best thing, though, is that the seats are not allocated. As long as you're courteous to players, it's easy to move between tables. You can watch lots of snooker for the money. And well, I just wanted to say it's a worthwhile alternative to fighting too expensive tickets for finals. And one more thing before I go. An idea for one of your top tens, if you'll indulge. Having watched Wu Yizhe forfeit his match against Chris Wakelin with an agonising the accidental tap of the cue ball, how about a countdown of the most costly fouls? Thanks as always for the podcast and commentary efforts. Thank you, Paul. It was nice to meet you briefly. I think I was off to commentate, but anyway. It is good value for money. I'm glad you enjoyed it. You do see a lot of players. That's one good thing, actually, about the best of sevens, in fairness. The matches there's a quick turnover of them. You've got four tables. You've got a lot of chances to see a lot of people. If you don't like one match, you can watch another one. And I think what's been good about Cheltenham is that the venue's been given a chance over the years. It was relatively quiet when they first went there. They stuck with it. It's built up. And I was talking to a player, actually, who said he thinks it's one of his favourite venues. He thinks he likes it in the race course. It's the Centaur. The Centaur is a venue within the race course. But it's a nice setting. It's a nice town. The players, it's quite a big venue. The players like it, I think. And it's been given a chance to grow. And as I say, this year they had record ticket sales. And you can't argue with that. But I just personally think they can look at the format of the tournament. I also met, again, Mark and John, who are two big snooker fans, who've been to two tournaments. So they said, we've just had a great couple of weeks at the English Open and British Open and would like to pass on our thanks to everyone involved for making it so special. We had tickets from the first day in Brentwood onwards. The snooker was great as always, and we met a few players who were all so nice and friendly. We even met Jason Ferguson, who was very kind and happy to take some time to chat to us. All the stewards and staff were friendly and professional too. At every level, WST made us feel truly part of the snooker family. On the Sunday, we attended the final. After years of watching live snooker, this was our first final. Wu's comeback was great to watch. We were sitting a couple of seats away from Neil Robertson's son, who was sportingly clapping Wu's performance, even though it was clear how much his father's return to the top mattered to him. The presentation was great to witness live. Even five rows back, we were covered in confetti, and we felt like we were part of snooker history. Congratulations to Neil Robertson. The next morning, we drove to Cheltenham in the pouring rain. Cheltenham's a really nice venue. Upstairs in the foyer, there was a snooker table where we met Sean Murphy and Mark Allen, We told Sean we would listen to his podcast on the drive home, but had listened to yours on the way there. He said he listened to Snooker Scene 2 on the way. Sean is always great to talk to and very generous with his time for the fans. We were also pleased to meet Stephen Allworth and thank him for his great addition to the commentary team. He spoke very highly of you too. We got to see Karen play well on the Monday and Tuesday, which was great as we're big Karen fans. All in all, it was such a great experience and a very enjoyable couple of weeks. We're now heading home to compete on our table for the Dave Hendon Trophy once again. Hopefully mixing with the best will help us pull a few balls for a change. Thank you again to everyone for adding to an amazing experience. That's great to hear, isn't it? You know, that's time well spent there. 2 weeks, two tournaments, and clearly they enjoyed it, which is great. And you're right, I think, to credit the staff as well at these events. They're long days, and, you know, a lot of people actually were at both. You know, I spoke to a couple of the security guys on the Monday morning. They got in at 4 a.m. from Brentwood. They're on the desk again at 12, you know, just doing the job and helping people enjoy the tournament. So thank you for mentioning those. Go back to Mark Williams, who wrote in earlier. Not that one, of course. He says, I'm enjoying the current barrage of snooker, or barrage, as Ken Doherty said on TV the other night, of snooker just now, and a very well done to Neil Robertson. He did well, but I do feel he isn't quite up to scratch yet and back to his absolute best, but he's not too far away. British Open has been possibly hampered by poor conditions on the tables, along with the 147 by Mark Allen. How poor they must be. I think that's what's known as sarcasm. Do you know why or what the reasoning is that the current world champion is playing on table two, while the main match on table one features other players? Is it because of the viewing figures some of the other players have are greater than Kyron? I see and hear quite a bit of discussion on this on various online sources, including from Kyron himself, who doesn't seem best pleased. Your insights on this will be appreciated. It's a bit of an understatement, I think, Mark, to say that Kyron doesn't seem best pleased. He's furious. Well, there's two things here. The conditions on day one were problematic. The weather was terrible. It was very damp. And it appeared some of the doors had been left open, which obviously was an issue in the venue. Mark Allen is a very interesting character. What I like about him is he is himself. He comes across as the person he is. He loves to I don't know, go to the sort of limit, really. So he didn't like the table, so he said it should be burned. Now, that seemed way over the top. And as so often before, he kind of rode back later. But in the moment, he said what he thought. I don't have a problem with that necessarily. But of course, a few days later, he made the maximum on it, which, so I suppose, you know, thankfully they didn't actually burn it. Otherwise, he couldn't have done that. And also, I think health and safety would have had something to say about it. Karen Wilson, though, on the point you make, well, I think this issue is misunderstood, not least by Karen himself. Firstly, there's never been any convention that the world champion has to play every match on television. That's never been a thing. If you go back to the 1980s, Steve Davis, the biggest name ever in snooker at that point, and still to this day, one of the biggest names ever in snooker, Thomas and ITV, and they would start their coverage in the last 32. So say the Fidelity Units Trusts International. And there's a lot to be said about the Fidelity Units Trusts International. In 1988, that was the final against Jimmy White. He made three centuries in a row. That's the first time that had been done. But they used to start in the last 32. And it would start on the Friday. But their coverage would start on the Saturday. But Steve would normally play his match on the Friday. So he wouldn't play on television at all. Why that was, looking back, it seems bizarre. But the point I'm making is there's never been a convention that if you're world champion, you play all your matches on television. Kyron Wilson played three matches in Cheltenham on table one. His fourth match was on table two. Had he won that, he'd be into the, what would it be, the quarterfinals, and he'd be back on table one again. If he'd won the tournament, he would have played six of his seven matches on table one. So what's the problem? The issue that night was there were a lot of interesting matches. And the table allocations are done by the broadcasters in concert with World Snooker Tour. They both have a say and an agreement is reached. And at ITV, it's quite democratic. You know, we're asked our opinions as the pundits and the commentators. And overwhelmingly, we all said, there's a couple of people who actually went for Jack Jones, Luca Brasel. But most people looked at it and said, Mark Selby, Tep Charanu, is the most interesting match. Kyron Wilson was playing Elliot Slesser, but we thought it was really about Tep Jaya more than Selby, almost. I mean, Selby's obviously a big name, but Tetchara is a really interesting player, really popular player with fans, and the contrast of styles with Selby we thought would be a really good match. And by the way, we were right. I mean, we might not have been, but we were right. It was a fantastic match. It went the distance. So Kyron was put on table two. By the way, it's in the same arena. It's next to table one. It's not in some car park outside. I think one of the issues, to be fair to Kyron and other top players, and Mark Allen on day one, I mean, one of the reasons he wanted the table burnt was because, again, he wanted to be on table one. He was playing Gary Wilson, so that's an attractive match. Mark Williams, defending champion, playing Rory Thor. There is a sort of unwritten convention, and it doesn't happen at every tournament, but it's sort of unwritten that the defending champion will play on day one, and he did. There's not room for everybody on table one all the time, okay? But one of the reasons for the players, to be fair to them, is they have logo deals. They want to be seen as widely as possible, as much exposure as possible, because they're paid a lot of money and, you know, that's part of the deal. So I understand that. But the fact is, he played three matches on table one, then he played one on table two. Had he beaten Elliot Slesser, he would have been back on table one for the rest of the tournament. I don't really see that as being sidelined. I thought his social media post was incredibly badly judged. It included swearing. It came across as very entitled and moany. And that's not Kyron, actually. I mean, his whole appeal is that he's down to earth. He's an ordinary guy made good. He's relatable. If he starts becoming a diva, I think people are going to turn against him. I would say to him and his brother that they need to look at how they are managing his, the way he's coming across. Because I don't think the way that was handled was very good. And then he went on TalkSport and doubled down. And I think that's actually where he could be in trouble, because he went on TalkSport and he accused broadcasters and Will Snooker of lying to him. That's a very serious charge. If he can't stand that up, he could be in serious trouble. So I don't think he handled it well. I understand his disappointment. We've all got ego, of course, and he's worked his whole life to become world champion. I understand that. And he feels he should be celebrated more. It's true that there have been matches this season, again, where he was not favoured. In Saudi Arabia, the problem there was, of course, they had to play around a day, so they really had to cram all the matches in. But the fact is, you know, we know the crowds were not good early on. When did they turn up? They turned up when Ronnie O'Sullivan was on. And he was on the same session, because it was done in terms of the draw. He was on the same session as Kyron Wilson. Now, the fact is, if they'd have put Ronnie on table two, all the crowd would have gone to table two, regardless of who was on table one. These are just realities, okay? In China, in Xi'an, the tournament he won, I think he started on table two, and they put him on table one. So he's had his fair share of it. But as I say, there's no convention to say the world champion's got to be on television every match they play. There just isn't. You know, the problem with some of these players is they don't look... I don't know whether they get to tournaments and just think all the prize money and all the sort of trimmings have always been there. They're there because the broadcasters put money in to show them, okay? So what we could do, if you like, is take all the cameras out, okay, and the players can pick when they want to play, and they can pick what table they want to play on. They can arrange it all themselves. But if they do that, they'll be playing for a few hundred quid. And if you don't believe me, ask the top billiards players. It's not about how good you are at snooker. It's about what commercial interest there is. Top billiards players are brilliant. They get no TV coverage, so the prize money is not very high. Okay, these guys are pretty lucky to be playing in this era of snooker. There's going to be times, okay, when you won't be chosen for the main table. The answer to that is not to go on Twitter and start swearing and complaining. We want our world champion to represent the sport in a professional manner. Okay, and it goes both ways. He also deserves the respect of those who show the sport and promote the sport. We have to work together. I thought last week it was not a good look at all. Moving on, we've got an extraordinary title for an email here. Thank goodness for the Brentwood Centre. Now, this is from Warren Smith, who says, long-time listener, first-time emailer. Really enjoyed the podcast and wanted to email in following a couple of visits to the English Open at Brentwood recently and to sing the tournament and venue's praises. I visited last year and felt I should return. I've not been to any other tournaments, so can't comment on other venues, but I do find the anti-Brentwood narrative a little irritating to listen to. Noisy doors, lack of atmosphere, etc. just strikes me as snooker snobbery. An accessible and reasonably priced venue that for a southeast of England resident is easy to access. Free parking, decent refreshments, plus four tables of top quality snooker is good enough for me.
I popped in on Friday's qualifying session and was treated to my first ever 147 live. Fantastic. That was Fang Zhengyi, of course. Then went back on Wednesday for 13 hours of snooker for £25. Wow, where else can you see so many top quality matches and competitors for that money? Hopefully it returns to Brentwood next year and many years to come, and you won't need to speak to the manager about the noisy door issue. Keep up the great work with the pod. Really enjoying the top 10 editions as well. Well, thank you, Warren. I'm glad you enjoyed it. And it's nice to hear somebody who's actually been to the tournament defending it. Lawrence Carpenter is asking about the World Grand Prix. Lawrence says, I noticed an article on the World Snooker website about an extension to the ITV contract, which mentioned the British Open, Champion of Champions, Players' Championship and Tour Championship, which is great news. However, the World Grand Prix was noticeably absent from the list, with the rumours about the tournament going to Hong Kong, which have recently seemed to go quiet. Is this a sign it's likely to move? I still don't understand why they might move this tournament away from ITV and the UK, rather than building on the successful Hong Kong Masters held last year, which seemed to have scope for growth. Do you have any insight? Well, Lawrence, the insight I have is that you're quite right. There's been a year's extension to the ITV snooker deal, so it will run until the end of 2025. It's not season by season, it's year by year. So the new deal would end with the Champion of Champions in 2025. You're right, Lawrence, to say the World Grand Prix is not included. We were told initially, or we were sort of led to believe, it would be in Hong Kong. It was mentioned on the World Snooker Tour website that it would be very likely in Hong Kong. We're now being told it probably won't be. So there's other places in Asia that are being talked about, but it doesn't look like it'll be in Britain. And because it's not in Britain, and because there's a 7-hour time difference, it's not attractive to ITV to show it, because they are funded. I mean, I would like to think that the people who run World Snooker know this, okay, but if they don't, I'll break it down for them. ITV is funded by advertising. Most of the advertising revenue they get is in prime time, i.e. past 7 o'clock at night. And obviously with the time difference, 7 or 8 hour time difference, all the matches will be over by then. So it's not attractive financially for them to show a tournament in another country. Regardless of then the costs potentially of having to send everyone out there, that's a separate issue. But just purely in terms of advertising revenue, it's not an attractive proposition. So they're not going to show it. Where it will end up, I don't know, in terms of geographically. Who will broadcast it, I don't know. It's a shame it's not on ITV, because, you know, it had always been their event, and it's part of that three-tournament series. I actually do not understand why this decision's been made. Initially, we were told, well, Hong Kong, you know, were involved in that potential rival tour, and maybe it's to do with that, but that seems to have gone quiet now. So I don't know. I don't know, but, you know, we're all waiting to find out, I guess. Now, Alex from Maidstone in Kent, he says, I just want to give my views on current events. What a wonderful few weeks us fans are having. Saudi, then the English Open, and now the British Open. And as I write, Mark Williams has just lost in a shock to Rory Thor. I was incredibly happy to see Neil Robertson winning trophies again, and not just because I have him in my World Snooker Tour Fantasy 5. I can really see him doing a lot of damage this season. Class is permanent. I just wanted to know if you think one of the up-and-coming Chinese stars will win a ranking event this year. Clearly, Wu Yizhe came close, and Si Jiawei is now in the top 15. I really think it would be fantastic for the game after the controversies with Bing Tao, Jingtong, Wenbo, etc. Thanks, as always, for your coverage and commentary. All the best. Alex, I think, yeah, I could see it happening. Si Jiawei is a player I've always kind of thought was very, very impressive. Wu Yizhe, as you say, you know, was amazing in that final. I guess you have to press on, don't you? You have to back that up, park it, and move on and try and, you know, do well in another tournament. But, I mean, look, the Chinese youngsters are, as a collective, incredible. So, certainly, if it didn't happen this year, you could see it happening, you know, in due course. Now, Dave Daly, I'll read his email. Greetings from Seattle. Last week you talked about cue safety and the fact that both Matt Selt and John Higgins had to replace their cues due to damage when travelling on airplanes. You also mentioned that professionals regularly fret when deboarding planes, hoping their cue made it intact, even when in a sturdy ski tube. How frustrating that is. I also travel with my cue in a ski tube, and I also fret and worry about damage every time I travel with it. I think I might have a solution, but it's unlikely the airports would adopt it without a lot of lobbying. Have you ever noticed, if you have really heavy luggage, the check-in desk adds a red label marked heavy to your luggage? They do this for health and safety reasons for the baggage handlers and protecting their back, etc.
but shouldn't they have another label available marked as fragile that they could add to the luggage when requested by the passenger? There should be a policy by airports and baggage handlers to treat that form of luggage more carefully, to place it in a different part of the airplane and don't stack things on it, etc. When shipping items through DHL or UPS, there is an option to mark something as fragile, and I have to believe that baggage handlers treat these differently to regular packages being shipped. So why is that option not available to passenger luggage? Surely it should. I imagine passenger queues aren't the only thing that gets damaged, so there is likely enough scenarios to warrant such an idea. When I'm on a plane, I can sometimes see baggage handlers literally hurl luggage on and off planes with little care, like a professional shot putter. But they don't do it with crates with animals in them. They don't leave the animal crates out in the rain for long, getting cold and drenched. Why? Because they intuitively know that animals are fragile and need to be handled with care. That includes separate part of the hold on the plane, etc. Surely if airports clearly mark certain luggage, like ski tubes, as fragile, there should be a separate baggage handler process with more care and attention given. I don't know why this type of policy exists with freight carriers, but not passenger luggage. We can hope it changes, I guess. Thanks again for all you do. Well, thanks, Dave. All I can think now is how do they handle a shot put on a plane? Now, I know that wasn't your question, but it seems an eminently sensible suggestion that. I think, look, the law changed in 2001 after 9/11, so it's 23 years. In that time, it's hard to believe a better solution hasn't been come up with. But maybe if anyone is listening, I'll end that sentence there. If anyone's listening. No, if anyone's listening, then maybe they could, you know, explain why that wouldn't work. Jeremy in Jersey says, I was watching the ITV coverage of the British Open and they were showing Rob Walker doing some quickfire questions with various people from the snooker scene, pun intended. One of them was Phil Yates and it was lovely to hear him say, you're his best friend in snooker. I'm sure it's entirely mutual. When asked about something embarrassing that's happened to him, though, he gave a rather weak answer about once saying it's 3-1 at the interval during a best-of-seven match when there was no interval. Dig yourself out of that one, he cried. Hardly the most memorable thing, surely. He reminded me of Theresa May's answer when asked if she'd done anything naughty as a child, and she said she'd once run through fields of wheat and the farmer wasn't pleased. Oh, come on. So I wondered, what are some of the best, worst snooker commentator balls-ups? I'm sure in Phil's years he must have had a better story than that. Have you given yourself a commentator's curse? I love the podcast. Keep up the good work. Say hello to your snooker friend Phil for me. Well, I think this is the first time Phil's been compared to Theresa May, and possibly the last. By the way, I'm going to defend her, and I wouldn't normally because I have no time for her. But but the thing with that interview was she was asked what was the most controversial thing she'd done when she was young. Now, and I'm not suggesting she'd ever done this, by the way. That's a caveat for the lawyers. But let's say she said, oh, I snorted cocaine off a toilet, you know, off a toilet seat in I don't know, Chepstow. You know, clearly that would be the end of a political career. So she'd gone for a very safe option, as you say, of running through fields of wheat. And she was panned for that as well, as being boring. So you can't really win. But anyway, that's not what you asked. I mean, look, we've all made a lot of mistakes over the years. You know, one of the worst things that can happen is your concentration goes, normally through tiredness, you misread the scores, you start saying someone needs snookers when they don't, or they don't need snookers when they do, or you even, you know, you're looking at the wrong player's score, or whatever. That can happen, it does happen. I think the worst thing I did was, the old Eurosport building where we started commentating, there were two commentary booths, and there was I think it was the Shanghai Masters, it didn't matter what tournament it was. I went in for a program. You normally go in about 15 minutes before you do a sound check and just get ready for the program. But I went in the wrong booth. So the booth that was going to be shown the snooker was not the one I was in. And it got to, I think it started at 12:30. And I'm sort of waiting for the program to start. I've heard no one, sound engineer's not been on, but I'm just waiting for it to start. And then I suddenly twig that I'm in the wrong booth. I raced to the other one. The program had just started, but all that had happened was the sort of introduction music. So you don't have to talk on that if you don't want to. So nobody knew until now. Now, again, just saying that is not the most exciting anecdote. I think if Parkinson was still going, they would probably cut that out of the edit. But it could have been a disaster. I could have ended up commentating on ski jumping or something. In retrospect, that's a dull story. I have been more sympathy for Theresa May now. It's not easy to come up with these things, you know. Let's try a bit harder with Ian Jolliffe, or Jolliffe maybe. A few episodes ago, you talked about Stephen Hallworth and how good his co-commentary is. It got me thinking about current players co-commentating and how it works. Do players tend to get approached by broadcasters when there is a need for an upcoming season, or are the channels badgered by requests from the players themselves? I wonder if you know whether a player has had to do a behind-closed-doors audition, maybe commentating on a recorded match with somebody like yourself. I guess this would not be the case for a very well-known, excellent communicator like Sean Murphy, but what about the lesser-known players? All players on tour have great knowledge of the game, of course, but inevitably some might not be the best communicator or succumb to nerves. Just wonder what the process might be. Well, Ian, I've said before that, Stephen started at the Championship League, and that, to answer your question directly, no, it tends not to be that you do a sort of recorded match. The best way of telling whether someone can do it or not is actually to do a live match, because if you're doing a recorded match, you've always got the safety net of knowing that, well, no one's really listening. If you're doing it live, you have to deal with the nerves and the reality that you're broadcasting, and also all the production stuff that you hear and all that, and going in the right booth is a big thing. So the Championship League, a couple of years ago, when Matchroom reached out to players and said, look, if you want to commentate, let us know. You know, that sort of sorted the wheat from the chaff in a way. We had a lot of people, well, actually, we didn't have a lot of people coming forward, but we had quite a few. We tried to fit them all in. It's happened since as well. And Stephen has emerged from that as an excellent commentator. He's taken on board, you know, the sort of rhythms of it, the disciplines of it. Obviously, he's brought his personality to it and his knowledge to it and his youth to it as well. And just a sort of nice way that he has about doing it, his enthusiasm and his, you know, his respect for the sport and the players, but also his humour, all that stuff is in there. But it started doing it at the Championship League. They're not badgered, no. What tends to happen is quite often if players are going down the rankings, they suddenly look at commentary as something they might want to do because they can see they might get some money from it and, you know, it's something that they might be good at. But in general, obviously a lot of the commentators are retired players because that, you know, gives a certain perspective. They're not on the tour anymore. You're quite right. People like Sean Murphy, still at the top of the game, also do it. I think it's good to have a mix. And Stephen Hallworth has come in and, you know, he's part of that mix now, Ian. So thank you for your question. We'll go now to Stephen and Michelle. If memory serves us correctly, you don't mind some Radiohead and going to the theatre when time permits, but I expect rarely at the same time. Will you be going along to experience William Shakespeare's Hamlet combined with Radiohead's album Hail to the Thief for the recently announced and most unusual new stage show? Well, this has been announced. Will I be going? Yes, probably. It's the answer, if I can. See how that goes. The Bends is Radiohead's best album. I'll brook no truck with anyone who disagrees. There's snooker in this email. They say, we're reminding ourselves of last year's title winners, both ranking and invitational. Trump O'Sullivan, Alan Williams, Wilson Murphy, Hawkins, Zhang-Ander Selby and Wilson, Gary Wilson. Which of last year's title winners do you think may struggle to win a title this season, ranking or invitational, based on the form so far? We know such questions are difficult to answer, as there are so many variables and players can often find form from seemingly nowhere, but we thought you'd have an informed gut feeling. It was great to see Neil Robertson will be on the list, but we do worry about Selby in particular. Now, of course, this was written, and I'm sorry to do this to Stephen and Michelle, this was written, obviously, before the British Open concluded. Spoiler, Mark Selby has won one now. Gary Wilson, of course, were giving the Scottish Open because he wins that every year. Zhang-Ander, before last season, I wouldn't have tipped him to win a title. And, you know, it seems sort of unfair to sort of say he won't win one this season, because why not? But, you know, he seemed an unlikely winner, but of course he backed it up. He was in two of the finals. Ronnie O'Sullivan's an interesting one, isn't he? And who thought we would say that? You know, he's this season, what, he's been in a semi-final, a quarter-final, two semi-finals and a quarter-final, which, you know, most people will be happy with, but he's used to winning tournaments. Be interesting to see if he can get back, you know, to anything like he was last season. We've seen Mark Williams and John Higgins in finals, of course, Class of 92 and all that already this season. Will Ronnie do it as well? We'll see, I guess. Think by the UK, the Masters, you could definitely see him coming to life there. I don't know, it's hard, isn't it? It's very hard to know. Obviously, Trump's already won. I expect to see Mark Allen and Sean Murphy in finals. And, yeah, Kyron Wilson's won one. So, Barry Hawkins, you mentioned there. Obviously, he has not won as many of the others, but you know, any of these players can come good at any time. And by the way, I mean, you've not mentioned this, but Oliver Lyons, congratulations to him for getting to the semis of the British Open. It was a long time coming, 10 years on tour. Obviously, you know, beaten 6-0 by John Higgins was a bit bruising. He didn't play well, but it can go one of two ways. John Higgins, this is true, okay, he's won, obviously, the British Open four times. The last three semi-finals he's won have all been 6-0, okay? And one of them, Sean Murphy, in 2004. Again, Sean was outplayed, but a few months later he won the World Championship. So that's one way it can go. The other way it can go is it's the only semi-final you're ever in. Obviously, Oliver Lyons has got to learn from it and take from it what he can. Belatedly mentioning him. We're going to end this week with Gavin Power, and there's a certain circularity to this, which is self-explanatory. So Gavin writes, Chow recently emailed you to say she'd love to meet up at the Cruise Board next year. She's a fan from China, and would give me a fan in appreciation of her role in my Ray Reardon tribute, the one you didn't follow. That was the one about the bat, I seem to recall. You also suggested that perhaps some of your listeners could meet up at the Graduate. I think both are fine ideas, and I'll tell you one reason why. My mum was diagnosed with cancer 3 weeks ago and unfortunately died on the 18th of September. During her last weeks, I listened to your podcasts on the way to and from the hospital, and it was a great comfort to have that familiarity to lean on. As humble as you are about your pointless podcast, I hope you know deep down that those who appreciate it really do appreciate it. Thanks for keeping up the endeavour. Well, thank you, Gavin. Deepest condolences to you. And I left this to last because, as I say, it brings us full circle in the week that we lost Clive Everton as well. So, listen, we are not the most vital podcast in the world, if such a thing exists. You know, there's thousands of them, and let's be honest. if most disappeared, we'd all get on with our lives. But the fact that you do listen and it means something to you means something to me as well. So, yeah, Gavin, I'd love to see it at the Crucible. Obviously, as a disorganised person, I won't do anything to organise it properly. It'll be a last-minute thing. But maybe to take Gavin from your own thing about Ray Reardon, we could send up the bat signal in Sheffield. What I'm really saying is Kelly Barker can organise it. Now, that's unfair on Kelly, who's kept out of this, and it's not her job. But if we all gather in Sheffield for the World Championship next year, and we can organise that, and by us, I mean Kelly, then the Graduate it is, we'll have a drink and talk nonsense. And that's frankly what we do every week. But I want to thank everybody again for their messages, their emails, and of course the circuit moves on. I mean, there's qualifying as we speak. Judd Trump's playing right now in the International Championship qualifiers. I mean, it just goes on, and that's good. The snooker world, the wheels of the snooker world revolve. I don't know what that means, but what I'm saying is it's non-stop action, and a lot of the guys going out to Wuhan. That will start Sunday, so it's a Sunday to Saturday tournament. It's live on Eurosport and Discovery Plus and other offices that you can find out about on the World Snooker Tour website about how to watch. A big event, you know, 140,000, the winner, Judd Trump, defending the title. And then we're back, I think this then Scottish Open qualifying, but certainly then the Northern Ireland Open, and so on and so on and so on. Busy times, and that's good. And that's it from the podcast. It's been going an hour. That's long enough for anybody. So thanks for listening. If you want to get in contact, snookerscenepodcast@mail.com. That's snookerscenepodcast@mail.com. We'll be back on Wednesday with a countdown to be decided. But yes, that's it. So as we always say, goodbye-bye.
This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
If you're a maintenance supervisor for a commercial property, you've had to deal with everything from leaky faucets to flickering light bulbs. But nothing's worse than that ancient boiler that's lived in the building since the day it was built, 50 years ago. It's enough to make anyone lose their cool. That's where Grainger comes in. With industrial-grade products and dependable fast delivery, Grainger can help with any challenge, from worn-out components to everyday necessities. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.